and welcome to a BBC prom that turns the clock back. Nearly half a century ago, in this very hall, on the 12th of September 1963, the composer Benjamin Britten conducted a programme of his own music to mark his 50th birthday. The cantata Misericordium, his Sinfonia da Requiem, and the Spring Symphony. And that's exactly what we're going to hear tonight. But there's a twist. That 1960s prom began with Britten's arrangement of Henry Purcell's Chaconne in G minor, the stately dance form in triple time that the 17th century composer particularly treasured. Tonight, however, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Mark Wigglesworth, is going to play a new arrangement of that Chaconne by the British composer Joby Talbot.
You've got one of the masterworks by one of the great composers ever, and certainly from this country, Purcell, which already exists in a perfectly serviceable and indeed wonderful version by one of the other great composers ever, and this country, Britten. So quite what I was supposed to bring to the table was a little bit worrying.
What do you think you did bring to the table?
I wanted to do something that kind of played up the archaic extraordinariness of the Purcell and some of the most weird stuff that's within there. I mean, it's this incredibly complicated, dense piece, very cerebral, and all this stuff is kind of hidden within it. And the main thing was just thinking, what can I bring to this that doesn't just seem kind of willfully perverse, and yet at the same time is different enough to warrant asking me to do it in the first place? So once I hit upon this idea of bells, that was kind of my way in. The thing about the Chaconne is that it has a repetitive bass line, and I thought if I was to put that on kind of different resonant instruments, and they would have all these kind of weird, archaic-sounding harmonics floating around the Royal Albert Hall, and everything else could sort of fit within that.
Joby Talbot, who's written a new arrangement of Henry Purcell's Chaconne in G minor, Chaconne being Purcell's idiosyncratic spelling of the French word chaconne. The BBC Symphony Orchestra is going to give the very first performance of Talbot's arrangement, and here comes the leader of the orchestra this evening, Andrew Haveron. And now, tonight's conductor. Coming onto the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall, Mark Wigglesworth, to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Joby Talbot's arrangement of Purcell's Chaconne in G minor.
Thank you.
The BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Mark Wigglesworth, have just given the world premiere of J.B. Talbot's arrangement of Purcell's Chaconne in G minor. And from where I'm sitting, you can see the wonderful array of bells that J.B. Talbot works into that arrangement of the Purcell. The second work in this evening's Britain Prom is the composer's cantata Misericordia. It's a later piece by Britten, composed in 1963, and it was a commission to mark the centenary of the International Red Cross. As his subject, Britten chose to set the parable of the Good Samaritan. And as you'll remember, the parable of the Good Samaritan occurs in St. Luke's Gospel, chapter 10, in the New Testament. A Jewish traveller is beaten, robbed, and left for dead alongside the road. First a priest and then a Levite pass by, both walking on the other side, avoiding the injured man. Finally, a Samaritan comes by. And Samaritans and Jews were generally enemies. They despised each other. But this particular Samaritan, to illustrate Jesus' point about good neighbourliness, helps the injured Jew. Well, I'm joined here tonight in the presenter's box at the Royal Albert Hall by the composer Colin Matthews, who worked alongside Benjamin Britten towards the end of his life. Colin, this was a commission for the Red Cross, a number of commissions that Britten received over his lifetime as a composer. How generally did he respond to commissions?
Well, the first thing was that he would have liked to have had plenty of time. I think when he received the commission for the War Requiem, he said, thank goodness somebody's asked me well in advance. And I think this was commissioned around 1960 for performance in 1963. So that gave him plenty of time to plan.
But he liked as much time as possible. But could he work at very short notice?
Well, he would work very fast when it came to it, but he would obviously need to plan ahead. I think this work was written in under a month, in May of 1963. And that's pretty typical of the speed, but of course he'd have been thinking about it for a long while before.
His original plan was, I think, to set a medieval Latin hymn, but this didn't seem to recommend itself to the International Red Cross.
Well, I think the Red Cross were very concerned that it should be a non-denominational work. I mean, it's not exactly what they got, because it clearly has a Christian theme, but the way that Britten frames the story distances it to a certain extent.
And is it important that it's set in Latin? Is there something about a Latin setting that chimes in with something that Britten thought was important?
Well, it's a mixture. I think it had that element of distancing. For a composer who was very concerned with setting things in the vernacular, it's perhaps a slightly strange choice, but I think he thought it internationalized it. The Latin was a language that was a universal language.
And there are, of course, precedents. One thinks of Stravinsky setting Latin texts, too.
Yes, and the Symphony of Psalms, I mean, was an influence throughout Britten's life. I think it was one of the major works that had an influence on him, as we'll see in the Sinfonia Requiem coming next.
And do you think it's also Latin because, in a sense, that connects with a European tradition, a European culture, which I'm sure, from all one knows, mattered a great deal to Britten?
I think that's the case, and you've got to remember how soon this comes after the War Requiem, which is, of course, the major Latin text setting. I mean, using the same two soloists, Pierce and Fischer-Dieskau, as had sung in the War Requiem.
Having had his original idea rejected by the Red Cross, or at least asked to think again, he approached Patrick Wilkinson, who was a classical scholar at King's College, Cambridge, and the libretto was fixed. There are two soloists. There's a traveller, sung by the tenor, and the Good Samaritan, who's a baritone, and a chorus. Do we know how much Benjamin Britten relied upon Patrick Wilkinson as they were working on this?
I think very much so in this particular case. I mean, often he would have a big influence over the course of the libretto, but this, I think, he felt because Wilkinson was a Latinist that he had the upper hand in that sense. And I know he took advice on how it should be pronounced and stressed.
And there are suggestions that, in fact, he perhaps listened about what the musical structure might be and form might be.
I think so, yes.
It's fairly austere musical resources. Piano, harp, timpani, solo string quartet, as we've said, and a string orchestra, two soloists, chamber choir. Very economical, if you think this was written immediately after the enormous complexities and size of the Royal Requiem.
Well, I think to some extent it's a reaction to it. I think Britten was both hugely gratified by the success of the War Requiem and possibly slightly disconcerted by it, and the works that immediately follow it are much more introverted and interned. But I mean, this is a very natural and practical way of setting the text, and I mean, it's a beautifully scored piece, even for such small resources.
And do you think there are links back to the Rorik here?
Well, I think there are in some ways. People have called it a kind of appendix to the Warwickium, and perhaps it's been overshadowed by it. And there is the link that the soloists actually sing I can't remember the exact Latin, dormi nunc, sleep, let us sleep now. It's almost the same words and a similar mood as the end
of the Rorikium too. I wonder whether, in a way, our trouble with this piece is that we've always thought of it, as you say, as an appendage to the Rorikium. Actually, it may mark a new start.
I think that's precisely what it is. It's actually moving in a different direction, you find, with the cello symphony, which came immediately afterwards, and looking towards the church parables, Curlew River. It's this new austerity.
Colin Matthews, thank you very much. In this evening's performance of Benjamin Britten's Cantata Misericordium, Alan Oakey is the traveller and Lee Melrose, the Good Samaritan, who rescues the wounded man from the roadside after others have passed by. And the two soloists coming onto the platform now with Mark Wigglesworth, who's going to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in this performance of Benjamin Britten's Cantata Misericordium.
Hekvia. Ah, Kamlonga est Hekvia. Campe deserta loca. Campe deserta loca. Teret messo di tutto. Teret is rupes. Omne arbustum in sitias tibio. In sitias tibio. Heus, 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 asine propera, propera. Oh, quam longa est hic via, quam longa, longa est hic via. Propera, propera, propera.
Oh.
Hospitum quises, und escensium quises, salvus corona tibi gratias referam dignas. Quisim, und escensium. Yeah.
who your neighbour is, now you know, sing the two soloists. Go and do likewise, the chorus responds. One should love one's neighbour as oneself. Benjamin Britten's Cantatum is a recordium written in 1963 to celebrate the centenary of the International Red Cross, but a parable that's as pertinent now as it was half a century ago. Alan Oakey was the traveller and Lee Melrose the Good Samaritan, and Mark Wigglesworth conducted the BBC Singers, chorus master Stephen Jackson and the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Well, we shall be hearing more from Alan Oakey in the second half of this evening's program, and he's one of the soloists in Benjamin Britten's Spring Symphony. Lee Melrose made something of a speciality of singing contemporary roles. He took a part in James McMillan's opera, The Sacrifice, for Welsh National Opera. Here, the soloist returns to the platform, encouraged to the front by Cymru's conductor Mark Wigglesworth. Lee Melrose also sang in Elliot Carter's On Conversing with Paradise at the Alborough Festival, Oliver Knussen conducting. Indeed, he's very much at home in the Opera House. This season, he sang in the United Kingdom premiere of Raskatov's opera A Dog's Heart at English National Opera, and he returns to Eno next season to sing in Weinberg's The Passenger, an opera with a very dark subject about the Holocaust and the journey to Auschwitz. Now we're to hear an earlier piece by Benjamin Britten, his Symphonia di Requiem. In 1939, the Japanese government invited Britten to write a work that would celebrate the 2600th anniversary of the Japanese imperial dynasty. It was something of a bizarre commission to invite a piece of official music from a pacifist, well aware that a European war was coming and who earlier that year had decided to leave England for America. Across the Pacific, Japan had recently embarked on her plan to conquer China, her militarism buttressed by Shinto, a state religion which had nothing at all in common with Western Christianity, certainly not requiem masses. Benjamin Britten's response, at least superficially, is perhaps as curious as the commission itself. He intended to write a work dedicated to the memory of his parents. And since it's a kind of requiem, he wrote to a friend, I'm quoting from the DA's era of the Requiem Mass. And for good measure, the young composer added that he was making it just as anti-war as possible. Small wonder, then, that the Japanese government gracefully declined to accept a work that they described as a purely a religious music of a Christian nature. But Britten himself knew that he had written one of his most successful compositions to date. Personally, I think it's the best so far, although it is so personal and so intimate a piece that it's rather like having one of those awful dreams where one parades around the place naked, slightly embarrassing. The composer, Colin Matthews, is still with me here in the presenter's box. Colin, was Britten right to see Symphonia di Requiem as one of his most successful compositions to date, do you think?
Yes, I think he was. It's new for him. It's a new maturity. Partly perhaps coming from the move to the States, but he'd been moving towards work of this stature for some time, and it's a major work, his first really major work, I think.
It does sound astonishingly original if you've never heard it before, indeed when you hear it again, that opening, I mean, there's something quite unlike anything.
There's nothing quite like it. I can't really think what the precedent is, and the extraordinary sonority that Britten gets from the orchestra is like nothing else.
And the shape of the piece in three movements.
Well, it's symphonic in some respects. I think Britten did think symphonically, and one of the models is certainly Stravinsky's Symphony in Psalms, Symphony of Psalms, and certainly the finale is very close to the finale of Stravinsky's symphony. But it's three linked movements which come together, I mean, in remarkable form.
And Britten gives each of those three movements a title from the Latin Mass for the Dead. A Lacrimosa to begin a Dies Irae, and then the A Requiem Aeternum. Do you think one should hear this more, perhaps, as a requiem than a symphonia?
No, I don't think so, really. I think the sheer orchestral colour and dynamism of it move way beyond anything that seems more like a requiem. And in a way, it's a sort of peg, I think, for the work to hang on.
What about the orchestration? Is there something distinct about the way in which he selects the instruments? I mean, there's a saxophone in the middle of the
orchestration. That's a very strange choice in a way. It's not something that he'd used a great deal before, but very characteristic, but I mean very, very un-jazz-like. One expects saxophone to be a jazz instrument. But everything about the work is deeply serious, and these rich, dark sonorities, I think, are what one hears more than anything.
Do you think there's an American connection there? But, I mean, the saxophone, perhaps the discovery of American music? I mean, after
possibly,
he's
but I don't see it there. Because some of the first works he wrote, when he gets to America, he's almost become a chameleon. They sound like Copland instantly, but this is very much him.
In the middle of this piece, there is, for me at least, the Medea's Era section, a terrifying, terrifying vision that maybe we shan't quite hear again in Britain's music, perhaps until we get to the Warwick again.
No, nothing,
the sense of the abyss.
Nothing quite like that. And again, it's not like a conventional Medea's Era. It's, as Britain calls it, a dance of death. And if it's like anything, it's like the sort of extremes of the work he wrote with Auden about 3 or 4 years earlier, Our Hunting Fathers.
In what kind of way is it like Our Hunting Fathers? Where do you see that?
Oh, I think the sort of the madness in it, the sort of it's verging on mania.
Do you think there was any other English composer, you know, in the first half of the 20th century who was writing quite like
this? No, I don't think there was. It seems to come out of nowhere. And even a work as powerful, say, and almost contemporary like Vaughan Williams' Sixth Symphony, it has a power, but it's quintessentially English, and that's not. I mean, Britain is looking at European models, and that's what makes it different.
I think that's fascinating, because what I also want here is the great lost opportunity, perhaps, in Britain, the opportunity he always hoped for, to have studied with Berg in Vienna.
Yes.
I mean, you just wonder how much of that is in this piece.
I think there's a lot of that.
Do you think we should hear it as a requiem for the composer's parents, or more perhaps thinking of the time in which it was written, Britain's own feelings, his journey to the United States, as a requiem or a lament for a world that is about to be plunged into war?
I think it's more to do with that. I mean, his parents had died quite some years before, and of course it's a tribute in a way. The strange thing is how he chose to write a work like this at the request of the Japanese government. It's a complete enigma.
But he is, in his own admission, he is writing a piece that takes a cue from his feelings about what is happening in the world at the time.
Oh, yes, and he says it's very much an anti-war piece, and I think those feelings come across very strongly.
Colin Matthews, thank you very much indeed. And here now, we're waiting for tonight's conductor, Mark Wigglesworth, to return to the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall, and here he is to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in a performance of Benjamin Britten's Sinfonia Per Requiem.
Thank you.
Sinfonia de Requiem, written when Benjamin Britten was just 26 years old, and already he forged, as Polly Matthews was saying earlier, an unmistakable personal music out of what he admires in other composers. Stravinsky, of course, but Mahler too. The BBC Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Mark Prokofiev. And what an enormous orchestra it is on stage here for Sinfonia de Requiem. And yet, how well Britten handles the enormous resources at his disposal, often making it sound, as does Mahler, of course, too, it sounds as if it's a series of chamber ensembles. Mark Wigglesworth at the front of the orchestra acknowledging the applause here in the Albert Hall. The piece that also quite clearly takes the personal and explores the public, perhaps, as well. Matches Britten's own grief at the loss of his parents, the memorial he's erected them, with his own apprehension about what was happening in the world in 1939 as he'd arrived in the United States. Mark Wigglesworth returns to the platform. And he's with us this evening, standing in, and how grateful we are, for an indisposed Jerzy Belhardych, who is unwell. But of course he's no stranger to the orchestra. He's conducted them before. And it's perfectly clear, sitting at rehearsals this afternoon, that they relished the partnership that they had re-established with them. Well, it's time for tonight's interval. And as the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall strolls out to take the air of Kensington, we on BBC Radio 3 go further west in this evening's 20 minutes to Kew Gardens, in the company of Virginia Woolf, who died 70 years ago. The reader in this story is Lindsay Duncan.
From the oval-shaped flower bed there rose perhaps 100 stalks, spreading into heart-shaped or tongue-shaped leaves halfway up, and unfurling at the tip red or blue or yellow petals marked with spots of colour raised upon the surface. And from the red, blue or yellow gloom of the throat emerged a straight bar, rough with gold dust and slightly clubbed at the end. The petals were voluminous enough to be stirred by the summer breeze, and when they moved, the red, blue and yellow lights passed one over the other, staining an inch of the brown earth beneath with a spot of the most intricate colour. The light fell either upon the smooth grey back of a pebble or the shell of a snail with its brown circular veins, or, falling into a raindrop, it expanded with such intensity of red, blue and yellow the thin walls of water that one expected them to burst and disappear. Instead, the drop was left in a second, silver-grey once more, and the light now settled upon the flesh of a leaf, revealing the branching thread of fibre beneath the surface. And again it moved on and spread its illumination in the vast green spaces beneath the dome of the heart-shaped and tongue-shaped leaves. Then the breeze stirred rather more briskly overhead, and the colour was flashed into the air above, into the eyes of the men and women who walk in Kew Gardens in July. The figures of these men and women straggled past the flowerbed with a curiously irregular movement, not unlike that of the white and blue butterflies who crossed the turf in zigzag flights from bed to bed. The man was about 6 inches in front of the woman, strolling carelessly, while she bore on with greater purpose, only turning her head now and then to see that the children were not too far behind. The man kept his distance in front of the woman purposely, though perhaps unconsciously, for he wished to go on with his thoughts. 15 years ago I came here with Lily, he thought. We sat somewhere over there by a lake, and I begged her to marry me all through the hot afternoon. How the dragonfly kept circling round us. How clearly I see the dragonfly and her shoe with a square silver buckle at the toe. All the time I spoke, I saw her shoe. And when it moved impatiently, I knew without looking up what she was going to say. The whole of her seemed to be in her shoe. All my love, my desire, were in the dragonfly. For some reason, I thought that if it settled there on that leaf, the broad one with the red flower in the middle of it, if the dragonfly settled on the leaf, she would say yes at once. But the dragonfly went round and round. It never settled anywhere, of course not, happily not. Or I shouldn't be walking here with Eleanor and the children. Tell me, Eleanor, do you ever think of the past? Why do you ask, Simon? Because I've been thinking of the past. I've been thinking of Lily, the woman I might have married. Well, why are you silent? Do you mind my thinking of the past? Why should I mind, Simon? Doesn't one always think of the past in a garden with men and women lying under the trees? Aren't they once past, all that remains of it? Those men and women, those ghosts lying under the trees? One's happiness, one's reality. For me, the square silver shoe buckle and a dragonfly. For me, a kiss. Imagine six little girls sitting before their easels 20 years ago, down by the side of a lake, painting the water lilies, the first red water lilies I'd ever seen. And suddenly, a kiss there on the back of my neck. And my hand shook all the afternoon so that I couldn't paint. I took out my watch and marked the hour when I would allow myself to think of the kiss for 5 minutes only. It was so precious. The kiss of an old, grey-haired woman with a wart on her nose. The mother of all my kisses, all my life. Come, Caroline, come, Hubert. They walked on past the flower bed, now walking four abreast, and soon diminished in size among the trees and looked half transparent as the sunlight and shade swam over their backs in large, trembling, irregular patches. In the oval flower bed, the snail, whose shell had been stained red, blue and yellow for the space of 2 minutes or so, now appeared to be moving very slightly in its shell, and next began to labour over the crumbs of loose earth, which broke away and rolled down as it passed over them. It appeared to have a definite goal in front of it, differing in this respect from the singular, high-stepping, angular, green insect who attempted to cross in front of it and waited for a second, with its antennae trembling as if in deliberation, and then stepped off as rapidly and strangely in the opposite direction. Brown cliffs with deep green lakes in the hollows, flat, blade-like trees that waved from root to tip, round boulders of grey stone, vast crumpled surfaces of a thin, crackling texture. All these objects lay across the snail's progress between one stalk and another, to his goal. Before he had decided whether to circumvent the arched tent of a dead leaf or to breast it, there came past the bed the feet of other human beings. This time, they were both men. The younger of the two wore an expression of perhaps unnatural calm. He raised his eyes and fixed them very steadily in front of him while his companion spoke. And directly his companion had done speaking, he looked on the ground again and sometimes opened his lips only after a long pause and sometimes did not open them at all. The elder man had a curiously uneven and shaky method of walking, jerking his hand forward and throwing up his head abruptly, rather in the manner of an impatient carriage horse tired of waiting outside a house. But in the man, these gestures were irresolute and pointless. He talked almost incessantly. He smiled to himself and again began to talk, as if the smile had been an answer. He was talking about spirits, the spirits of the dead, who, according to him, were even now telling him all sorts of odd things about their experiences in heaven. Heaven was known to the ancients as Thessaly, William, and now, with this war, the spirit matter is rolling between the hills like thunder. He paused, seemed to listen, smiled, jerked his head and continued. You have a small electric battery and a piece of rubber to insulate the wire.
Insulate?
Well, we'll skip the details. No good going into details that wouldn't be understood. And in short, the little machine stands in any convenient position by the head of the bed, we will say, on a neat mahogany stand. All arrangements being properly fixed by workmen under my direction, the widow applies her ear and summons the spirit by sign as agreed. Women! Widows! Women in black! Here he seemed to have caught sight of a woman's dress in the distance, which in the shade looked a purple-black. He took off his hat, placed his hand upon his heart, and hurried towards her, muttering and gesticulating feverishly. But William caught him by the sleeve and touched a flower with the tip of his walking stick in order to divert the old man's attention. After looking at it for a moment in some confusion, the old man bent his ear to it and seemed to answer a voice speaking from it, for he began talking about the forests of Uruguay, which he had visited hundreds of years ago, in company with the most beautiful young woman in Europe. He could be heard murmuring about forests of Uruguay blanketed with wax petals of tropical roses, nightingales, sea beaches, mermaids, and women drowned at sea, as he suffered himself to be moved on by William, upon whose face the look of stoical patience grew slowly deeper and deeper. Following his steps so closely as to be slightly puzzled by his gestures, came two elderly women of the lower middle class, one stout and ponderous, the other rosy-cheeked and nimble. Like most people of their station, they were frankly fascinated by any signs of eccentricity betokening a disordered brain, especially in the well-to-do. But they were too far off to be certain whether the gestures were merely eccentric or genuinely mad. After they had scrutinised the old man's back in silence for a moment and given each other a queer, sly look, they went on energetically piecing together their very complicated dialogue.
Nelbert Lot says Philpa, he says, I says, she says, I says, I says, I says. My bur, says Bill Grandad, the old man, sugar. Sugar flakippers greens. Sugar, sugar, sugar.
The ponderous woman looked through the pattern of falling words at the flowers, standing cool, firm and upright in the earth, with a curious expression. She saw them as a sleeper waking from a heavy sleep sees a brass candlestick reflecting the light in an unfamiliar way and closes his eyes and opens them, and seeing the brass candlestick again, finally starts broad awake and stares at the candlestick with all his powers. So the heavy woman came to a standstill opposite the oval-shaped flower-bed and ceased even to pretend to listen to what the other woman was saying. She stood there, letting the words fall over her. swaying the top part of her body slowly backwards and forwards, looking at the flowers. Then she suggested that they should find a seat and have their tea. The snail had now considered every possible method of reaching his goal without going round the dead leaf or climbing over it. Let alone the effort needed for climbing a leaf, he was doubtful whether the thin texture, which vibrated with such an alarming crackle when touched even by the tip of his horns, would bear his weight. And this determined him finally to creep beneath it, for there was a point where the leaf curved high enough from the ground to admit him. He had just inserted his head in the opening and was taking stock of the high brown roof and was getting used to the cool brown light when two other people came past outside on the turf. This time they were both young, a young man and a young woman. They were both in the prime of youth, or even in that season which precedes the prime of youth, the season before the smooth pink folds of the flower have burst their gummy case, when the wings of the butterfly, though fully grown, are motionless in the sun. "Lucky it isn't Friday," he observed. "Why? Do you believe in luck?" "They make you pay sixpence on Friday." "What's sixpence anyway? Isn't it worth sixpence?"
"What's it? What do you mean by it?"
"Oh, anything. I mean, you know what I mean."
The couple stood still on the edge of the flower bed, and together pressed the end of her parasol deep down into the soft earth. The action and the fact that his hand rested on the top of hers expressed their feelings in a strange way, as these short, insignificant words also expressed something, words with short wings for their heavy body of meaning, inadequate to carry them far, and thus alighting awkwardly upon the very common objects that surrounded them, and were to their inexperienced touch so massive. But who knows, so they thought as they pressed the parasol into the earth, what precipices aren't concealed in them, or what slopes of ice don't shine in the sun on the other side. Who knows? Who has ever seen this before? Even when she wondered what sort of tea they gave you at Kew, he felt that something loomed up behind her words and stood vast and solid behind them. And the mist very slowly rose and uncovered. Heavens, what were those shapes? Little white tables and waitresses who looked first at her and then at him. And there was a bill that he would pay with a real 2-shilling piece, and it was real, all real, he assured himself, fingering the coin in his pocket, real to everyone except to him and to her. Even to him it began to seem real, and then, but it was too exciting to stand and think any longer, and he pulled the parasol out of the earth with a jerk and was impatient to find the place where one had tea with other people, like other people. "Come along, Trissy, it's time we had our tea." "Wherever does one have one's tea?" she asked, looking vaguely round and letting herself be drawn on down the grass path, trailing her parasol, turning her head this way and that way, forgetting her tea, wishing to go down there and then down there, remembering orchids and cranes among wild flowers, a Chinese pagoda and a crimson-crested bird. But he bore her on. Thus one couple after another, with much the same irregular and aimless movement, passed the flower bed, and were enveloped in layer after layer of green-blue vapour, in which at first their bodies had substance and a dash of colour, but later both substance and colour dissolved in the green-blue atmosphere.
How hot it was. So hot that even the thrush chose to hop like a mechanical bird in the shadow of the flowers, with long pauses between one movement and the next. Instead of rambling vaguely, the white butterflies danced one above another, making with their white shifting flakes the outline of a shattered marble column above the tallest flowers. The glass roofs of the palm house shone as if a whole market full of shiny green umbrellas had opened in the sun. And in the drone of the aeroplane, the voice of the summer sky murmured its fierce soul. Yellow and black, pink and snow white, shapes of all these colours, men, women and children, were spotted for a second upon the horizon, and then, seeing the breadth of yellow that lay upon the grass, they wavered and sought shade beneath the trees, dissolving like drops of water in the yellow and green atmosphere, staining it faintly with red and blue. It seemed as if all gross and heavy bodies had sunk down in the heat motionless and lay huddled upon the ground, but their voices went wavering from them as if they were flames lolling from the thick waxen bodies of candles. Voices. Yes, voices. Wordless voices, breaking the silence suddenly with such depth of contentment, such passion of desire, or in the voices of children, such freshness of surprise. Breaking the silence. But there was no silence. All the time, the motor omnibuses were turning their wheels and changing their gear, like a vast nest of Chinese boxes, all of wrought steel turning ceaselessly one within another, the city murmured, on the top of which the voices cried aloud, and the petals of myriads of flowers flashed their colours into the air.
Lindsay Duncan was reading Virginia Woolf's story, Kew Gardens, and the producer was Justine Willett. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's BBC Prom, live on BBC Radio 3, with me, Christopher Cook. You can find programme notes, of course, for every prom on the prom's website. It's the usual address, that's www.bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, there's just one work in the second part of this evening's prom. It's the same final work that the audience heard here in the hall back in 1963 when Benjamin Britten conducted exactly the same programme of his own music for a 50th birthday party concert at the Albert Hall. It's the Spring Symphony, scored for the three vocal soloists, soprano, mezzo and tenor, a large choir and orchestra. This Spring Symphony was a commission in 1946 from the émigré Russian conductor Serge Koussevitzky, but it would be 3 years before the conductor got his symphony, and in the meantime the composer's plans for the piece had changed considerably. He had jettisoned the idea of Latin texts in favour of English poetry. A particularly lovely day in East Suffolk, the Suffolk of Constable and Gainsborough, made me change my mind, he wrote. The work in 4 parts and 12 separate numbers, and it tracks the passage of deepest winter into glorious spring, just into summer, through settings of poems by Spenser, Nash, Herrick, Clare, Milton, Henry Vaughan, W.H. Auden, William Blake and others. The fourth and final section is from Fletcher and Beaumont's play The Night of the Burning Pestle, first performed in 1607. But almost the very last word goes to that great 13th century traditional round, Summa is a Cumanin, intoned by a boys' chorus. The composer Colin Matthews is still with me here in the presenter's box at the Royal Albert Hall. Colin, in what sense is the Spring Symphony really a symphony?
Well, it's in 4 clear movements, but those movements are subdivided. I mean, there are 12 separate sections in all.
Only the finale is one poem in itself. The others are all divided between them. But it's basically a big opening movement, introduction and first movement, then a scherzo, then a slow movement.
There's a sort of feeling that Britten never wrote a symphony, but he is clearly a symphonist, and a work like this, as indeed the Symphonia Directa, demonstrates quite clearly his gifts as a symphonist.
Oh, yes, and after all, there are two concertos as well, which are symphonic in shape, and the cello symphony. They're all symphonic. He had a mastery of form.
We're reminded what a master of Britten was, too, at setting words. I mean, why these particular English poets?
Well, it's a particular choice. I mean, Britten's texts are very idiosyncratic. Often they're minor poets. The same is the case with the Serenade and the Nocturne. It's a mixture of the well-known and the rather obscure, but a wonderful choice.
It was a difficult work for Britten to compose. Do we know why he found it difficult?
I'm not sure. He certainly found the whole progress, the opening of winter to spring, a very difficult one to get going. And he wasn't in great health during the time. He often, of course, he protests, you know, this piece is impossible to write. It means he's taking a few more days than usual.
Colin Matthews, thank you for being with us this evening here in the presenter's box. Soloists for tonight's performance are Benjamin Britten's Spring Symphony, Amanda Rukoff, soprano, Christine Wright, mezzo-soprano, Alan Oakey, being brought on stage by tonight's conductor, Mark Wigglesworth, BBC Singers, Trinity Boys Choir, BBC Symphony Chorus and the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducting in this performance of Benjamin Britten's Spring Symphony by Mark Wigglesworth.
messenger of spring. His trumpet shrill hath thrice already sounded, that warns all others, wait upon the king. Who now is coming forth with garlands crowned. Noise whereof the choir of birds resounded, their anthem sweet devised of love's praise, that all the woods their echoes back rebounded, as if they knew the meaning of their lays. Amongst them all, which did love's honour raise, no word was heard of her that most it ought. But she his precept proudly disobeys, and that his idle message said had naught. Therefore, O love, unless she turn to thee, her a rebel be.
When the sky meets the sea and chop 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 chop, I believe. I love the sing, I love the name,
subject be content to hear me what I say. With gilded star and crossed star, the Lord, here I stand. Rejoice, O English hearts, rejoice.
Rejoice, O city, rejoice, 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 rejoice
symphony not only dealing with the spring itself, but with the progress of winter to spring and the reawakening of the earth and life that that means. The composer's own words. The soloists in that performance are Benjamin Britten's Spring Symphony with Amanda Rukoff, soprano, the mezzo-soprano Christine Rice, the tenor Alan Oakey. Mark Wigglesworth conducted the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the Trinity Boys Choir, BBC Signals and the BBC Symphony Chorus. And the stage is full of performers for that very large work. Before a very happy, I think, Royal Albert Hall audience. A rare chance, too rare perhaps, to hear Benjamin Britten's Spring Symphony. Well, I'm sure the soloists will be returning shortly, and an immensely distinguished trio of soloists. Alan Oakey has a strong connection with Benjamin Britten. He's sung performances of Aschenbach, the hero of Britten's last opera, Death in Venice, and here indeed come the three soloists back onto the platform. He sung Death in Venice at Aubra and the Bregenz festivals, as well as the Canadian Opera, and he sung Peter Grimes at the Royal Opera House. Bowing to the audience, and audiences who go to Royal Opera House may have seen him create a brand new role, Old Man Marshall at the world premiere of Mark Anthony Turnage's new opera earlier this year, Anna Nicole. Joined, of course, by the two women soloists, who both, I notice, studied at the Royal Northern College of Music. Anna Rukoff was recently singing also Britten in Peter Grimes, and earlier in the season gave a splendid account of the Mikropoulos case, Janáček's final, the penultimate opera. Chorus Masters now, having a bit led by Mark Wigglesworth. Chorus Master of the Trinity Boys Choir, David Simpson. Huge roar of applause for the boys, neatly dressed in ties and white shirts. And Stephen Jackson, the Chorus Master, the BBC Singers and BBC Symphony Chorus. Mark Wigglesworth brings the whole orchestra, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, to their feet. Well, that's it from the Royal Albert Hall this evening. The BBC Symphony Orchestra will be back on Monday the 22nd of August, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard, for a programme which includes Brahms' First Symphony and the world premiere of a new piano concerto by Kevin Volans. Barry Douglas is the pianist. You can hear tonight's Britten Prom again, though, on BBC Radio 3 in afternoon on 3, 2:15 this Wednesday. That's the 17th of August. Or you can listen again for the next 7 days via the BBC Radio 3 website. Soloists, chorus masters, tonight's conductor returning to the platform. Tomorrow night's prom at 7:30 is a ballet. Valery Gergiev brings his orchestra of the Mariinsky Theatres in Petersburg to play Tchaikovsky's great ballet for Swan Lake. But for now, as the applause continues and is certain to continue, I think, for some while at the Royal Albert Hall, I'm going to hand you back to Jonathan Swain for the rest of this evening on BBC Radio 3.
Christopher, thank you. Christopher Cook there at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, looking ahead to the rest of the evening here on BBC Radio 3 in about 12 minutes' time, the Sunday feature Theatre at the Front Lines. Zeynep Badawi reports from Khartoum on theatre groups helping those caught up in the conflict. That's at 9:30. And it's followed by this week's edition of Words and Music. Tonight, a sequence of texts and music inspired by photographs and photography. And then at 11:30, jazz lineup devoted to the Ethiopian jazz master Astatke, who's at the Glasgow Jazz Festival, where he's joined by a host of British jazz musicians, among them Byron Wallen and Tom Skinner. 11:30 for that. For the moment, back to Benjamin Britten for chorus. His flower songs, they're from the year after his Spring Symphony. In fact, three of the settings here are by poets he also set in the Spring Symphony, John Clare and Robert Herrick. Britten adding to these Marsh Flowers by the Aldborough poet George Crabbe of Peter Grimes fame. John Elliot Gardner conducts the Monteverdi Choir, and this first of the flower songs is called To Daffodils. Benjamin Britten's Five Flower Songs, the Monteverdi Choir, there conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. And a brief Britten encore to follow it, one of his folk song arrangements, the Bird Scarer's Song. The baritone is Gerald Finley and the pianist Julius Drake.
Shoo, birds, you bees are black, when I lay down to have a nap. Shoo, arlo, arlo, arlo. Arlo, 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 birds. Hi, shoo, birds. Hi, shoo, birds. I'll tov master's ground into Tom Tucker's ground. Out of Tom Tucker's ground into the Coles' ground. Out of the Coles' ground into Bill Peter's ground. Shoo, arlo, arlo, arlo. Arlo, 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 arlo birds. Ha, ha!
Benjamin Britten's arrangement of the Bird Scarer's Song, the baritone Gerald Finley and the pianist Julius Drake.
The 2011 BBC Proms sequence of Saturday matinee concerts continues with a date in which two of our leading composers rub musical shoulders. On BBC Radio 3, we go live to London's Cadogan Hall for a performance of this work, Il Rosso Martello, by Peter Maxwell Davis, and the UK premiere of Harrison Birtwistle's eagerly awaited composition, Angel Fighter. A Saturday matinee at the BBC Proms, starting at 3 o'clock.
It's just gone 9:30, and for tonight's Sunday feature here on BBC Radio 3, Theatre at the Front Line, Zainab Badawi visited Sudan, a country which experienced years of civil war when 2 million people died and 4 million were uprooted. The programme was recorded before this year's referendum, which led to the creation of an independent South Sudan. Zainab Badawi met those involved in theatre, song and dance, whose aim through their work is to bring reconciliation and healing to the people who suffered during the conflict.
Drums and cymbals herald a performance by a visiting theatre group in a conflict-ridden part of Sudan. All the villagers are invited to come and watch and take part. In another part of Sudan, a group of women singers, the Hakamas, bring their songs of peace to towns and villages. They, as well as theatre and dance companies, are dedicated to the rejection of violence, and they use their performing skills to sound out their message. I began my visit to Sudan in the capital, Khartoum. During these civil war years, many of those who were working in theatre witnessed at first hand the suffering of those caught up in the conflict. One of those was the actor and writer Mustafa Ahmed Khalifa, an important figure in both Khartoum's national theatre and in the activities of the group that's been trained to take theatre into conflict zones, such as southern Sudan, Kordofan and Darfur. The memory of the violence is still vivid for him.
Because I lived in Darfur, I know Darfur very much, very kind and lovely people. I know a long time before this conflict and before this fighting how they are living. Because I have seen this place and I lived there, this is something very, very hard for me and very strong for me. Here in Khartoum, last year, Khartoum and Omdurman invaded by one of these militias. We feel in terror, nobody can get out, nobody can move, nobody can travel. So what has happened in every place in the Sudan, it is also happened to us here in Khartoum. We feel it deeply. This is a great pain for us.
At that time I said, okay, so the theater can do something. I said, this is a theater between two frontiers. Because each one, he have his own fence, a very strong fence, a wall, concrete wall between each other. So I feel that the role of my theater is a bridge between this tribe and this tribe, this group and this group.
This is Ali Mahdi, indisputably the leading figure in theatre in Sudan. A charismatic actor in his younger days, he's now putting his energies into every kind of theatrical initiative, organising workshops, sending actors for special training, and taking theatre into areas that have seen death and destruction. Ali Mahdi is an active member of the Charity for Orphan Children, SOS, which has also focused his attention on the problem of returning child soldiers. Sometimes these boys are trained from the age of 8 to shoot and kill. At the end of the war, they found they had no place to go.
I was working in South Sudan, in Upper Nile State, in Malakal city, where we have a camp for the ex-child soldiers, you know, some of this group, some of the army, whatever it is. So I believe very much from that place, from that camp, I start talking with them. But it was difficult to let them come together even to eat. Each group, they are separate. They still came with the violence inside them. When we start making rehearsals, they came little by little, slowly by slowly.
What were they like? Were they nervous? Were they fearful?
Very, very tough, still very strong. They never accept each other. They never accept me at the beginning at all. But we have to do something. We have a group of theater, we have a group of musicians, we have a group of folklore dance, make a circle, and we play. After 1 month, I feel they are more flexible to accept each other.
We call the people in market by this song. Nikanjia villawiya villawiya, nikanjia villawiya villawi. Nikanjia villawiya villawiya, nikanjia villawi.
Awad Hassan is one of the actors in Ali Mahdi's group, and his song calling people to a performance intrigued the local people in the market square of Malakal city in the south of Sudan.
Some people come to looking what happened here. Some people is coming slowly, 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 slowly. And after 1 hour, we have a big audience. The whole market closes. no market now. It is theater.
Using performance, he brings the child soldiers into the heart of a community which once feared them, giving them confidence that can help them return to a normal life. Malakal has been a constant flashpoint between pro-North fighters and Southern forces, and these young former soldiers, rootless and orphaned, came drifting back into the city. Awad Hassan worked with them for 6 months, befriending them and slowly developing a trust long before their eventual performance.
I am start by the games. I like these games. My job, how to be these people relax in mind, in body. I build new body for them. Not body like soldiers, but good body for artists. It is hard job because I am teach the soldiers how to make this a change between soldiers to artists. They come to Malakal without any guns. They come by foot. He come by foot, not find the family, not find village. But I talk with them, put the gun down. Which gun in your head? Put the gun in your head down. Now no war. The war stopped. The war stopped. Put the gun down. Put the soldiers down. Now you are a boy here. You are alone here. Without father, without mother, without anything here. You're alone. I need to help you. How to help me? Put the gun down. Put the soldiers down.
The rehabilitation of child soldiers is one aspect of this healing process. But also, it's been women and children, defenceless and violated, who've just as much needed to be given back their status in the communities. Ali Mahdi's groups of actors include female actors like Amira Al-Madris. In a society where custom can keep the sexes apart, it's vital to offer them support.
It is very important for us to visit areas of conflict. Many women there will be living in a place that is almost closed. Even to come to the theater production would be a big problem. There have to be women actors there.
Amira remembers one visit in particular to Darfur, where the actors face the real horror of the conflict.
2 years ago, we went to Darfur 4 or 5 times in a very difficult period of the war. We went to Kass, and there had been a battle the day before, and there were 40 victims. People were very sad, and part of the village had been burned down. We arrived to perform to them, and this was very difficult. How could we interact with people like this? We went to the market and bought clothes and dressed like them. And we sat with them, and we talked about the burying of the dead, and we offered our condolences. We changed our planned performance, and it was one of the best things we did.
And the agenda for discussion which Amira and her fellow actors open up goes deeper than helping to repair the community.
We can use theatre to discuss anything. We have been trained in workshops to talk about things which are often silent. We can talk about equality of men and women, how men and women should be the same. Women in rural areas don't have the right to pick their husbands. We talk against these bad customs and how to make their lives more interesting.
The performance will usually include song, dance and music, as well as dialogue. In this way, it can shed light on the experiences of the men and women in regions like Darfur, which have seen the worst of the conflict. By being encouraged to take part, the spectators become involved in dealing with conflict issues.
They are fighting each other, they have some difficulties between each other, the conflict starts. We have a solution. Our imagination to the a solution of this part of the story. We came to the place with our drums, with our songs, and of course, the songs of the people of Darfur. We use their songs. This is why they are being involved. They are partnership, they are not audience. And they are very important in the performance. And either they hold the flags or they play part of the drums if they are interested, if they know that, or they can stop the play and they change the story. When I said my play is 50 minutes, this depends on the audience, on the partnership. Sometimes we play for 3 hours continuously.
You have a centre for theatre in conflict.
Yes.
How far do you draw on the ideas of somebody like Augusto Boal?
We are not far. I met him 2 times. I visit Brazil 2 times. This is the Forum Theatre, the idea of Augusto Boal.
Augusto Boal, who died at the age of 78 in 2009, was the Brazilian-born theatre director, writer and theorist who believed theatre should be a force for radical change and the empowerment of what he called the oppressed.
What we want is to dynamize people. That is, if I am oppressed, I have legitimately the right to fight against my oppression and to try to be not oppressed, to try to free myself from that oppression. So our theater, the theater of the oppressed, of course, does not aim at reaching a balance, calm, but on the contrary, to make things change for the better. That is, we always say that if we wait for the future to come is the worst possible. So we don't have to wait for it, we have to create it. The future will not come, we should go to the future.
And as a way of introducing Boal's theories to his own actors and writers, 5 years ago, Ali Mahdi took a group to Berlin to work with German members of the International Theatre Institute, highly experienced in training people in Boal's progressive forms of theatre. They then returned to Khartoum with the Sudanese actors to supervise their ideas being put into practice. I wondered whether the director, Thomas Engel, had any doubts about importing their European experience to the very different culture of Sudan.
Our idea was not to make a kind of top-down relationship with knowledge and transfer of ideas from Europe to Africa. We were much more interested in having a real exchange because of the Sudan, end of 2004, when we arrived there first, was definitely on the starting position of being a kind of transition country, a kind of after-civil war country with all its steps forward to a civil society. And that's why we thought that there would be an enormously good soil for theater projects and for starting culture projects beside all the NGO work there.
In what way can theater help heal scars within communities and also between different ethnic groups?
It can help in starting dialogues, steps which create the possibility of speaking and of exchanging about dreams, about feelings, about nightmares, whatever. So that creates the first steps of socialization, re-socialization.
We don't present a play like a propaganda that gives a message. No, 30 years ago, we spoke very much about theater of a message. And then whatever the play was, we asked, what? But where is the message? The message. So the theater became a sort of post office to deliver messages. And those messages sometimes could not be accepted by the oppressed. They said, well, you say that, but come on here and do it yourself. So now we do theater of really of the oppressed. That is, we present a play in which there is a character, the protagonist, and he or she does not know how to solve a problem. And then the play finishes. And then we say, well, we are going to go back again and perform the same play and the same actions. And whoever has a different idea can say stop at any moment, jump on the scene, replace the protagonist, and try a different solution. And then using the theatrical language, which is the most universal, it is the human language par excellence, that's the real language of the human being. Using that language, they try to analyze ways of getting rid of their oppressions.
Augusto Boal's democratic approach to theatre allows groups the flexibility to adapt to their particular situation. By so doing, theatre can play a role that allows it to go into areas which are closed to others. Ali Mahdi.
There is camps, nobody can go inside that. Government, UN, nobody can go. But with my drums, with the actors, with the costume, we go inside and we make our show, our performance, and I'm sure they are enjoy it. If we can make the piece for 3 hours, if we can keep nobody kill each other for 3 hours, in a big city like Cass or a camps like Bushok, for 3 hours, everybody in the camps came and enjoyed dancing. Young ladies, old women, kids, men, we can use it in not solving the problem. Nobody can solve the difficulty of the world, not us. But we have at least a new vision of life that can help those people to understand each other.
The work of Ali Mahdi and his group of actors is just one of the different initiatives for peace and reconciliation which come out of the performing arts. This car is taking me and a team from the United Nations to a displaced persons camp on the outskirts of Khartoum. It's a huge site which is now a permanent suburb to the capital city, housing thousands of people in fairly basic conditions. And down one of the dusty streets, the car emerges into an open square and the sound of singing fills the space. I've come along to listen to a group of women who've come all the way from the southwestern province of Kordofan. They're known as the Hakama, which in Arabic means the wise ones. And these are women who traditionally had a role in playing and singing songs to goad their men into battle, to boost their morale. But now they've turned their singing talents to singing songs for peace. There are about 9 or 10 women here. They're all dressed identically in very colourful saris, yellow and gold. Some of them are wearing headdresses and bracelets on their ankles, and one woman, I think she's the lead one, has got a fairly arm of substantial gold, actually. And we've come to a kind of makeshift theatre because there's a platform where some of the locals are coming to enjoy the afternoon's entertainment, including me. But although it is entertaining, there is obviously a very, very serious message underlying these songs and the whole purpose of this project. The person most involved in developing the Hakamas as a way of spreading the message of peace is Maha Freijoon. She's a tireless worker for the North Sudan Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration Commission, which grew out of the United Nations DDR initiative. The Hakamas are her pet project.
These women, they can do a very significant role in our work toward encouraging the community to settle in peace and to live in harmony.
Do their men listen to them? Do they say to the men, stop fighting, we want you to stick to what peace we have at the moment?
Yes, yes. Very, very strong message when they send. And the men, by the way, they are afraid. One Hakama, she stand and start to say a name, because they are always start their song by a name. And every man in this area afraid to be in the dumping area.
So they kind of name and shame those who are not sticking to peace.
When the war it is, he's a coward because he's not fighting. And when the peace come, he's a coward because he's not want to put his gun down and listen for the voice of the community.
I noticed that the women I was listening to and watching, they come from different tribes in the province of Kordofan, and these are tribes that once fought together, but they are now singing together. Is that just something superficial, or is it something that really is going to be long-lasting and quite deep?
Yeah, it is. It starts by training them to be in harmony as a group of Hakamas 3 years ago. But now they are leading, driving all the community to be in peace and harmony. So that is why the women that are willing to move forward for the peace, they are ready psychologically to maintain the peace more than the men.
Well, this is a very jolly song. It's saying peace is as sweet as dates with honey. Peace is as sweet as the milk in a cow. So it's, you know, that's a kind of variation on the theme. Peace is as sweet as apples hanging on a tree. These songs are very much improvised, and she's now urging me. She's saying, Zainab, say, there's nothing sweeter than peace. So I will oblige, I'll say it. As-salamda hilu hala. That's what she's saying. Okay, well, we've just been joined by the lead singer from the Hakama. Hueda, I believe, is your name. I think I'm going to have to revert to Arabic to talk to her here and ask her how long she's been in this Hakama group singing peace songs now. Intileki kam sana hasa bidghanni ma'al Hakama. So she's been singing for 4 years. Does she believe that singing peace songs is very important? She says there's nothing like singing for peace. It's absolutely wonderful, and it's vital that we sing for peace. And now we see children going to school, and it's important to build on that peace. I just asked her if she used to sing songs to boost the morale of the men before they went into battle, and she said there were women who did sing songs, battle songs, but now everybody is singing songs for peace. I'm going to ask her now, though, how far she has suffered, or perhaps family members have, through the conflicts that have gone on in Kordofan. She says that she lost many of her family members, she was just telling me, in the war. And so she really is so happy that there is now peace. She says she can walk for up to 60 kilometres and not worry about being attacked or anything like that. And that it's really only since peace has come that she feels she can actually sleep at night. She's saying that a brother, uncles, cousins, about 21 members of her family died in the conflict that was going on in Kordofan, and she's looking rather mournful at the moment, a little bit tearful. So I suppose it obviously brings back very sad memories for her. You can see now why she sings with so much enthusiasm and dedication to ensure that as far as she can in her own way through her songs, try to just make sure that what peace has come does actually hold. Peace, may peace come to the Nuba Mountains, is what this song is about. Sarah Douglas is part of the United Nations Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration Initiative, and she believes completely in the role the Hakamas can play.
In these communities, people were literally fighting with their neighbors, fighting with the next tribe, and tensions that were already there, perhaps over water or grazing or other issues, became exacerbated. When we first encountered the Hakamas in 2006, saw a tremendous opportunity for them to be a vehicle for spreading positive messages about DDR and also positive messages about peace and the post-conflict period throughout their communities. So that's really where we saw them to be of use to us in our program.
Why do you back a project which deals with performance arts as a way of conflict resolution?
Well, I would say there's two answers to that. The first one is that in these communities there's a very high rate of illiteracy, 90%+ across most of rural Sudan. So making posters and flyers and putting things on TV when people don't have electricity is not effective. The second reason is that the Hakamas are indigenous to these areas. So we feel that it's much more effective to communicate to people in the discourse and mediums that they're used to from their communities, and that it'll have a much greater impact when they're being spoken to in their own language and through their traditional media.
The enmity between tribes caused some of the worst fighting in the civil war years in the south. And the Hakamas include a mix of tribes, and the fact that they're singing in unison is another way of bringing people together. One artist, Stephen Ochula, composer of this song about hope and unity for the continent of Africa, is primarily a choreographer and he runs his own dance company. He's made a point of blending the steps of different tribes into his dances.
The group, they're from different tribes. We have Dinka, we have Danzand, we have Moro, we have Bari. All the tribes that in South Sudan we create a new language. And when I dance, you can just see, if you know about our dance, you can see dance from the Dinka tribe, from the Shuluk tribe, Latuka tribe, in the same time in one person. And when you dance to the audience, they know you, you're from the Dinka tribe. But now you dance my dance, oh, they say, amazing, how this guy from another tribe, they dance my dance. That means he believe in me and accept me. And then you say, okay, now you are my person. And this way, we bring them together. This is the way to bring people to be in unity. We as artists, we try to focus using theater or dance theater to send the message, you are one. Don't be against other. We are in South Sudan, we are one people, one culture, and one behavior, everything is one. Some people, they were thinking about, you always think about unity with your own way. I say yes, because I'm an artist. I'm just for human being everywhere. I'm not just for the Northern or South Sudan. I'm for every human being everywhere. I'm for that. I'm against the war, against the fighting, I'm against everything hurt the people, hurt humanity.
I'm here at the National Theatre in the Omdurman district of Khartoum, which this week has been taken over by the Al Bugha Arts Festival. And they're going to be putting on a show every night in the amphitheatre, which can seat up to 1,000 people. I'm just here in the forecourt of the theatre. People are milling around, greeting one another, having a drink, a soft drink. Young men, women mixing together. Evening prayers are being said. And the weather being so reliably hot in Sudan, the forecourt's in the open air, and so is the theatre. Well, people are making their way in now, so better go and join them.
The play is set in a bakery in Khartoum. The foreman goes off to attend to his sick mother, leaving behind his three workmates, who all jockey for position as foreman. There's a fight where memories of conflict, both domestic and military, are played out. And then the foreman returns and peace and routine are re-established.
Well, the play is over. Packed house. Audience seemed to love it. It lasted about an hour. Performances were pretty powerful, actually, and I was quite surprised. Some pretty well choreographed movements, too, quite acrobatic. But I really enjoyed it. And being in open-air theatre and being Sudan, it doesn't rain, which is wonderful.
The night before, there was a very different play. An ensemble cast made up of actors trained in Ali Mahdi's company workshops put the play on in an open space next to the main theatre. With the audience on all sides, it gave a flavour of what a performance in a refugee camp might be like. This is a story of village people, with the men and women going about their working lives with petty squabbles, flirting, a wedding, a birth, and in the audience, anonymous for most of the play, a man in a suit who turns out to be the taxman, rising suddenly from his seat and pursuing the villagers for their unpaid taxes. It's a lost cause, and the audience relish a situation they know well. Many of the plays in this week-long festival are on the serious side, but here is one with all the comedy stops pulled out. The director, Abdulrahman Mahdi, knows his audience well.
Comedy is the best way of reaching an audience, getting to the heart of the audience, especially the Sudanese who enjoy humour. They like to smile and laugh a lot. As for my depiction of the tax inspector, trying to take his role seriously and extract taxes from the villagers, the way I chose to depict him was as close as I could get to a puppet, and in that way, showing him to be doing the bidding of the government.
I asked Abdulrahman Mahdi whether this piece had similarities with the plays staged in the conflict zones. Its informal setting had the audience, from babies to grandparents, almost overflowing onto the stage and making direct contact with the actors.
I like to do my work anywhere. In the street, under a tree, in the market, even under the traffic light when they stop. That's my preferred way of putting on shows. I like it this way because I think the audience are not passive. They are part of the performance itself. That's satisfying for me. I present a complex situation and I present possible solutions and I ask the audience members how they might resolve this complex situation. It might even be dancing with me.
One of the smash hits of the El Bugha festival, directed with wit and movement, it ended with the audience joining the cast in a celebratory dance, or as many as could cram onto the bare floor of the stage. The play showed the skills of the actors, and I can imagine them putting these to good use in camps, villages and cities. But how will this work carry on in the future? Ali Mahdi was keen to show me the potential of his arts centre, still under construction, but which will offer every kind of performance skill.
This is the centre, Mahdi Centre for Art. And I try to have a place where the artists can meet, where they can have some performance, exhibition also, training courses. And they do some small production, like maybe TV program, maybe radio, drama, such a thing like that.
Okay, so we're going inside your courtyard now through yes. green doors, and you can see the building in progress here.
Theatre, small theatre here in this area.
So it's a kind of outdoor theatre, and yes, it can take about 400, open-air theatre.
Four to 500.
400 to 500 people, and yes. then you'll have a small...
This is the stage.
Stage here at the
here.
Back.
A small stage. Inside you can see.
Okay, let's see inside.
This is the main big hall we have. You can see.
Hang on, let's go in. So we've now gone inside and more. It's almost done, actually, isn't it? So yes. what is this? This is an alternative venue to perform, is it?
This is for the exhibition, the art exhibition for painting, photography, and also for workshop. Training actors and actress, dancing, so we can use it for these activities. And so also sessions, we have sessions. You know, a small concert of, you know, the, what they call it.
The centre will be a fantastic resource, but it's in the city and the real work is needed outside.
Next year we will sit to evaluate what we did in the last 5 years. And one of our weakness is the continuation in our work outside of Khartoum. In Khartoum, today we have a workshop in the field of puppet theatre related with children's theatre, related with theatre in conflict.
But sustainability in regions outside of Khartoum, and in particular difficult environments.
Of course.
You accept that there are limitations to what you can do?
Yes, I accept. I'm fighting. I'm trying to do all the effort.
But there's only one... So much, even though you lead this centre for theatre in conflict zones, there's only a limit to what one, even somebody as energetic and enthusiastic yeah. as you, can accomplish. But your efforts are sustainable. You can say even when you leave yes. these regions
Absolutely.
And you come back, you feel you've put down
Absolutely.
More than just the
Absolutely.
Basic groundwork.
We have a good system. The way to make the training or the workshops, we have a good experience. Okay.
How many regional networks do you have all across Sudan then?
We work mainly... In Nuba Mountain.
In Kordofan.
And in Kordofan,
that's
Lubayin.
The province of Kordofan.
Yes, and mainly in Darfur. The whole big Darfur cities like Niala, Jenina, and El Fasher.
And then in the south, you just have the one program in Malakal.
Yes. We try to develop. Also,
but what about the east of Sudan? Do you have any projects there that are ongoing?
No, we are planned for the last part of the year. In November, December, to start in Kassala. We feel there is a lot of things need our support. Our plan is to start in October, November, December, to start in Kassala. So that will be the first one.
You get the impression that it's very much a project where the work is an ongoing process.
Of course.
The International Theatre Institute has supported Ali Mahdi's initiatives and in Khartoum was the Secretary General of the ITI, Tobias Bianconi. I took the opportunity to ask him how the Sudanese theatre in conflict zones fitted into the ITI's plan and how it might develop.
I don't know how you say it in English, but in German it's like a hot drop on a stone. And we do it, and we do it, and we do it, and we continue doing it. And Theatre in Conflict Zones, that was initiated here, I think if we can make people aware that there is not always only fight, that there is a possibility of peace, then it's drop after drop that
makes it. But how do you judge that awareness? I mean, how do you know that you're not just facilitating the ambitions of a small group of theatre workers in any particular country and that there are real benefits for the wider community?
It's difficult to judge it, but I think what we experience and what people tell us is that it really is making peace and getting peace out. But
so you just rely on what people tell you?
Well, what do you else? Let's say when I came here the first time 1 year ago, there were other people here and talked about critical issues about the theatre in conflict zones. I know that 2 days ago, the director of the information ministry told me that